Stay tuned. But right now we want to welcome back to our show Sean Stevens from the group FIRE, Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Sean, first off, good morning, and thanks for being brave and coming back to our program today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. We're going to talk about free speech today, and we've had Sean on the program a couple of times before, mainly around the idea of college free speech and expression and so on. And Sean, I definitely want to ask about that, but I want to save that for later on. All right. When I reached out to you recently, it was just about the idea of free speech. And, you know, what are things like right now, you know, with the different political landscape? I mean, we had you on, I think it was October of last year. Well, the political landscape has changed. It's different now. You know, and how does that affect free speech and such? First off, let's start with some basics for folks that maybe aren't familiar with FIRE, or they're a relatively new listener, so they don't know what FIRE is and so on. If you would, tell us something about yourself. You know, what do you do? And tell us about FIRE. Tell us about your group.
Sure. I'm the chief research advisor at FIRE. My background is I have a PhD in social political psychology, and have been doing survey-based research at universities and for nonprofit organizations for over a decade. FIRE stands for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. We were originally founded as the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. So the former, I think the best way to explain the former is it's kind of an old-school ACLU that dealt strictly with college campuses and defending the rights of students and faculty. And then a few years ago, we expanded those efforts to move off campus, and now we have that goal for all Americans.
All right. And you folks are based in Philadelphia.
Yeah, we're based in Philadelphia and have a second office in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense. I'd get that. All right. Let me, Sean, just this is a wide open general question. All right. We're in 2025. How are free speech rights today? Just sort of in our country, just in general, is it going, oh, things are going great, or, oh, boy, we're really struggling in different ways and so on? Just sort of an open-ended question, how is free speech in America here in 2025?
So I'll start the preamble with effectively when you investigate or research this topic, I know a lot about it. I think the one thing you would say is one always has to have some level of vigilance for defending against threats to speech and where they may come from, and the climate and kind of social political changes can change where some people perceive those threats are coming from. I think you'll get a very polarized view. I actually know from our own data that the view on how free speech is doing is quite polarized. Probably wouldn't surprise most of the viewers here to learn that prior to the election, Democrats thought things were doing pretty well and on the right track, like a majority of them, and Republicans felt the opposite. As usual, independents were always somewhere in between them. And this has completely flipped since the election last November. Republicans feel a lot better about the direction of free speech in the country right now, and Democrats are now a lot more concerned. I think that's pretty normal. It's like a political effect, you know, who's in power versus who's out of power. But so I'd say, I guess, overall, it's probably a mixed bag, and it's going to depend on who you talk to and what their politics are.
All right. So if things have flipped, that obviously means that free speech has somehow changed. I mean, if things have changed, if people feel differently, something must have changed. Besides the obvious, there's a different guy in the White House now. I mean, what else?
I think that's the main factor. I think the main factor is the switch in leadership and you know, who controls the country. I mean, it's a very clear partisan effect when Democrats controlled the White House and Democrats had the expectation that they were going to win the election. They felt very good about it. Republicans being out of power, and I think they also thought they were going to win the election, but they weren't in power, and had you know, a number of examples they could point to over the last decade or so of government censorship against them. I think they rightfully were concerned. And then to see it flip because now, you know, you have a Republican president, Republican-controlled Congress, I think it's a largely a partisan effect, I think.
But actually,
I don't think much has changed, like on the ground per se. It's just who's holding the lever of power, and then how they're using that in this space.
Sean, actual free speech hasn't changed, right? It's the same.
Yeah. I'd say for the most part, yeah. I mean, this is largely a polarized perceptions, and it's due to people's politics. A lot of it, I would say, yeah.
See, I bet there are people listening. They're like, no. They're disagreeing with that. I guess, okay, here's a silly question, Sean. All right? This is like elementary school, maybe. Give us a definition of free speech. All right? Hopefully most people know this is in the First Amendment. For goodness sakes, folks, please tell me you know that. Freedom of speech. What is your definition of free speech? What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so the protections we have in the United States are stronger than anywhere else in the world. There's very few things that are deemed not protected, right? So these are incitements to violence, but kind of that it's going to happen immediately after you make the speech, right? So saying, oh, hey, I'd like to drop a bomb on this country in response to something on Twitter is not going to be that doesn't fall under incitement to violence because the person posting that probably doesn't have the power to drop a bomb on anybody, and they're just like saying something in a forum. A different circumstance would be if you're like literally outside someone's house and there's an angry mob and you're basically directing them to storm the house. That might be considered unprotected speech. Child pornography obviously falls under this as well. A few other things that are deemed extreme obscenity. But for the most part, most speech, even lies, misinformation, even what a lot of people would call, quote, hate speech, is protected by the First Amendment.
Okay, now there's a good question, Sean, because we see the term hate speech still tossed out every now and then. You know, some big court case or we're going after somebody and so on. And I've always found, this is Scott, I've always found hate speech to be very nebulous. Can you give a definition of what exactly hate speech is? Because sometimes that thing, that title gets thrown out very quickly. Oh, there. What exactly, from your perspective, what exactly is hate speech?
So legally, it's not a concept in our country. If you go off of how it's interpreted in other countries, or what I think what most people mean when they use the term is that they have in mind speech or expression that's kind of derogatory, maybe laden with stereotypes about specific groups that kind of puts them down. The argument is effectively that this causes actual, like, physical harm, which is debatable. There's some psychological evidence that say, harmful, offensive words, hurtful words can cause physiological changes and, I guess, emotional harm. So, I mean, there's, like, a subtle debate there. But I think what most people have in mind is terms like that. But those terms are generally protected unless they're being used in a way to, like, incite violence.
How often does that happen, Sean? I mean, do you folks keep statistics or something on this?
We don't have statistics on it, but through conversations I've had with many of the lawyers at FIRE, proving incitement in a court of law is very difficult.
All right. That sounds
so
right.
The charges might be, the charges are probably far more commonly filed than actual convictions occur, but I wouldn't even be able to tell you how common it is that people file like a charge of incitement against someone else. We don't have statistics on that like right at hand.
Now, you had a comment a couple of minutes ago that free speech in America is, I'm paraphrasing, like better than any place on the planet. they're rounding here. They're like 200 countries on Earth. There isn't another country that has, I want to say has free speech, but I mean the same level of liberty with their speech. There isn't another country on Earth that has that level when it comes to speech. There isn't anybody, not one country.
No, we have the strongest protections for free speech in the world. Clearly, there is levels like a good deal of freedom of speech in countries like Canada, Western Europe, most of Europe, but even within those countries, there are more restrictions on what can and cannot be said. And I'll use the UK as kind of an example. You know, recent years, over the past 5-10 years, there's been a number of laws introduced there that allow the government to punish people for things that we would find like pretty egregious here. And would be very upset about if our government was punishing people for.
I was going to ask, do you folks do surveys or whatever from other parts of the world? Is there some measure out there that you folks have or somebody else has of free speech rights?
Yeah, so we have a employee on staff who's kind of like our international free speech expert scholar, Sarah McLaughlin. She has a book coming out later this summer, Authoritarians in the Academy, details kind of how foreign influence has seeped in to U.S. colleges and universities through kind of dark money funding and other ways, and it's impacting speech on those campuses. We also have a research fellow who has a free speech center at Vanderbilt University, Jacob Meacham-Gama. He wrote a book, like a free speech history book, that came out a few years ago. I don't know if he's still affiliated with this outlet in the Netherlands. He might be, he might not be, but it's justitia.org. They have some measures of free speech that they've looked at in Europe and internationally. So I would recommend checking their stuff out.
All right. Now, COVID was 5 years ago. Oh, boy, did we have lots of things flying around about COVID. What, from your knowledge or research, what did we learn anything from the whole COVID situation? Like, okay, we can say this. Well, no, you can't say that. Well, wait. Did we learn anything from the whole COVID episode from 4 or 5 years ago?
So I'm a little optimistic that we're on the way to. I do think that in the scientific realm and in kind of the epidemiology realm, the, you know, like the tarring and feathering of Jay Bhattacharya, who's now the head of the NIH, for effectively saying we need to study these things, you know, we need to do empirical research on these lockdowns, on this mRNA vaccine, like, are these things going to work? These are actually empirical questions. We shouldn't just assume that because public health experts have said so, that this is what we need to follow. I think, you know, the last 5 years with the data coming in has largely shown that his take was probably the right one. And I think at least within some elements of the academic scientific community, that I'm optimistic that is will create a little bit more open-mindedness and not rushing to kind of just implement things that we think sound right. I'm not an epidemiologist, but as far as I can tell and what I've looked into and from some of the ones I've spoken with, there's not really a lot of peer-reviewed evidence to suggest that social distancing and the mask wearing that we did was going to be as effective as they said. And I think that was the point that Jay was making along with his colleagues when they wrote the Great Barrington Declaration. And, you know, in science, he's proposing an idea, and it's a testable idea, so we should test that idea. We shouldn't just label it a conspiracy theory and dismiss it. So I'm optimistic that in some spaces that has prompted some changes. But broadly, I mean, I still see a lot of the same things that we've seen to be wrong, like the research that we've done since COVID, I still see people repeating those. So on a broader sense, I don't know if we've learned very much.
Along those lines, can you talk about the challenges that come with the internet when it comes to free speech? Because I think most of us, well, actually, I don't know. Maybe we'll ask you about that later. I think I would hope most people understand that what we're free speech is that the government can't limit it. It doesn't mean that there's no consequences. If you say something and your business fires you because of something you said, that's not a violation of free speech. They want to have an image for their company. I think some people still get a little confused about that. But most people, I think, have the general understanding. Where I do think it gets a little complicated is with an industry that is regulated by the government, and where you may, and during COVID, at least reports are, you had government officials, hey, you need to take that down. That's not the message we're trying to get out. Well, that, I mean, we're into some at least gray area when it comes to the internet. Can you just talk about the challenges of what is or isn't an infringement on free speech when it comes to the internet in particular?
Yeah, so I think we, at FIRE, we can distinguish and do. There's free speech in the legal sense, which is what you've described with, that's protection from the government. The government is not, there's some limited domains where the government actually does have to act to protect your ability to hear someone else, right? Like if someone's trying to shout down a speaker in a public domain, like that's violating someone else's right to listen.
Yep.
So the government should, government actors should step in and allow this speech to continue. But those are like rare. Those are much rarer instances. But we'll also talk about a culture of free speech, which I think that's like when people do get upset over, I tweeted something online and then a mob of thousands of people came after me and I lost my job. Yeah, that's a consequence. But I think what people get upset about is the mob, like the mob aspect of it. And it's like a thing that, if you said quietly to your two buddies in the bar, probably nothing happens. So I think the challenge comes in with social media being this, there's a wide audience out there now for most people, a much wider audience than I think we're psychologically equipped to handle. I think I've spoken about this before with Scott. We're kind of ideally, we're built to live with like 100 in a community of like 100, 200 people. And you're on social media, and now millions of people are exposed. You're exposed to the thoughts of millions of people. They can see your thoughts. And so it's a much more challenging speech environment because, there's that many more people out there that might get offended by what you said, and that many more people that they can rally in support of, dealing consequences out to you. So I think that it's a very tricky thing because I don't think we can turn this spigot off of social media. It has a lot of problems. It also has its benefits as well. And so it's like we have to figure out a way to balance this better.
All right, let's put in a break here. Our guest again is Sean Stevens from FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. When we come back, Sean, I've got some recent instances that have made the news involving free speech. And yeah, we got to talk about college campuses because we got a big one kind of right next to us, right over here. So stay tuned for that, friends. You're listening to Let's Talk on 98.7 The Fox, and we will come right back.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox.
Interest rates and inflation are out of control. Is your credit card debt also out of control? It's time to resolve your debt and take back control for a lot less than what you owe. If you have $10,000 or more in credit card debt, then you need to call us right now. Debt Fix Pros can significantly reduce the amount you owe, and you could be debt-free faster than you think.
I knew we had to do something. Our debt was growing.
It was getting out of control, and we just didn't know what to do.
We saw an ad for Debt Fix Pros. We called, and they showed us how fast they could get us out of debt.
It really was amazing, and now we're back in control.
Call now, and we'll show you how easy it is to fix your debt. The call and consultation are free. Call Debt Fix Pros right now. Call 800-930-0388. That's 800-930-0388. 800-930-0388. Our military heroes deserve our thanks. Patriotic Hearts is there to assist those in need, especially in the transition back to family and civilian life. You can help by donating an unwanted car, truck, SUV, or van. Your donation supports the programs that make a difference in the lives of veterans and those actively serving our country. Call today for a fast, free pickup. Your donation will not only be greatly appreciated, but will also qualify as a tax deduction. Call 800-917-1544 to help our military heroes. Call 800-917-1544. Operators are standing by 24/7. Patriotic Hearts, helping our soldiers and veterans live a better life. Call 800-917-1544. That's 800-917-1544. Together, we can make a difference.
Are you looking for the best pizza in town? Look no further than Brothers Pizza in downtown Belfont. Good, fast, and did I mention really good? Brothers Pizza also delivers to the immediate area, but you can also enjoy sit-down dining with convenient on-street parking. For fast, friendly delivery, call 355-5581 or stop by at 102 North Allegheny Street in downtown Belfont. Brothers Pizza, downtown Belfont.
Have you checked out our new website, 987thefox.info? When you do, be sure to scroll to the bottom, enter your email address. Then sometime soon, you'll be a 987 The Fox insider with our newsletter feature, thoughts from some of our hosts that you won't get on our shows, messages from sponsors, and even special deals as an insider newsletter exclusive. We'll take good care of your email address, no sharing or selling. Hope you'll join us on 987thefox.info and enter your email address at the bottom. Be an insider, only from 987 The Fox.
Interest rates and inflation are out of control. Is your credit card debt also out of control? It's time to resolve your debt and take back control for a lot less than what you owe. If you have $10,000 or more in credit card debt, then you need to call us right now. Debt Fix Pros can significantly reduce the amount you owe, and you could be debt-free faster than you think.
I knew we had to do something. Our debt was growing.
It was getting out of control, and we just didn't know what to do.
We saw an ad for Debt Fix Pros. We called, and they showed us how fast they could get us out of debt.
It really was amazing, and now we're back in control.
Call now, and we'll show you how easy it is to fix your debt. The call and consultation are free. Call Debt Fix Pros right now. Call 800-930-0388. That's 800-930-0388. 800-930-0388.
It's the 42nd Annual Belfont Arts and Crafts Fair, a committee of historic Belfont. Friday and Saturday, August 1st and 2nd, in beautiful downtown Belfont, and admission is free. Enjoy juried artists offering handmade original work, youth artists, live entertainment, children's activities, and delicious food vendors. New this year, hometown crafters. Learn more at BelfontFair.org and follow them on Facebook. Sponsored by the Happy Valley Adventure Bureau.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox.
It's Let's Talk here on a Tuesday morning. A little open phone time coming up in the final segment of today's big show.
All right. Freedom of speech. First Amendment, along with some other freedoms in the First Amendment. We're talking with Sean Stevens from FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. We'll mention their website, which is really informative. It's thefire.org or thefire.org. Check out their website. Now, Sean, real quick, I actually got the website up, and right at the top of the page, your president or leader, and I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. Greg, how do you pronounce Lukianoff. His last name?
Lukianoff.
Lukianoff, okay. He apparently did one of those TED Talks, which I think they're pretty cool. TED Talks.
Mm-hmm.
And without me, you know, playing it or something, what was the purpose of his TED Talk?
It's basically walking through, the importance of free speech, why we need to be kind of eternally vigilant for it, why it's always under threat, what is not protected, why it's important, as I kind of mentioned a little bit before the break, why it's important to promote a culture of free speech. So this moves beyond just free speech in the legal sense, and it's building a culture of people who can disagree without being disagreeable with each other.
Huh. Yeah, I also do wonder if do you have any surveys or anything? Or my evidence here is very anecdotal, and I'll admit that. But it does seem like that maybe the younger generations here are not as maybe up to date on what free speech actually is. Like, I've seen some interviews, and it's like, oh, yeah, no, I'm all for free speech. And then it's like, all right, well, you know, should the Ku Klux Klan be allowed? Well, no, you can't have that. Well, I again, when we were growing up, I mean, it was clearly taught, like, you don't have to agree with the speech. And, in fact, free speech is actually you need to be fighting for speech that you completely disagree with. That is the whole idea. And it feels like maybe we're losing the concept here a little bit with the younger folks.
I think that's a good read. About 10 years ago, I was working at Heterodox Academy and New York University before I worked at FIRE, and John Haidt and I put out a series of pieces effectively arguing that the younger generation seems to be less tolerant and has different attitudes towards free speech. This kind of spurred a debate with some other academics. And our stance at the time was effectively, look, we're seeing these trends in the data, but there's only like a few years of it. So sure, the jury's still out, but we think this is effectively going to be borne out as time goes on. This past year, Greg Lukianoff and I basically updated that series with the rest of the decade of data, which I think kind of bears the story out that the younger generation is less tolerant and more willing to call for censorship of speech they dislike. That in and of itself isn't like a new thing. That's a pretty common thing with most people going back to at least the 1950s, if not before, in survey data. If you ask people, hey, are you for free speech? Do you think it's important? How important is it? Pretty much everybody says, yes, I'm for it. Of course, I defend it, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, well, what about the Nazis? Or what about this conservative guy over here? What about this progressive person over here who said something objectionable? And then you start to see the support drop. So that's not unique to this generation, but I think you see it as stronger. And a thought I have on that, and this is more of a hypothesis, and I wouldn't be able to support this as strongly with data, but I think, to go back to what we were talking about a little bit before the break, I think the social media has something to do with that. Kids are, I remember dialing up to connect to the internet, meaning like I remember the internet being like released to the public kind of as a thing, versus people getting to college today. They've been online their whole lives. They've been on social media for years, and social media affords them the ability to basically curate their experience. So they're used to being able to do that.
Are we seeing an uptick in action against free speech? Meaning, you know, we every now and then, and I wouldn't say it's necessarily all that frequent, but this speaker at this rally, and then either there's like an actual physical assault, or people, you know, there's a table set up, and it's like, well, we'll destroy the table and we'll rip up the banners and that kind of stuff. Instead of, again, what I always suggest is if you see a sign that you don't like, what I like to do is look at it, say, huh, boy, that's a stupid sign, and then I walk past it and I move on with my day. Seems like we have some folks that are just unwilling or unable to do that.
Yeah, so we actually maintain three different databases, and so what I'll say is relative to campuses and not off campus. But we maintain three different databases that look at speech controversies and their outcomes. The first one is the campus deplatforming database. So this looks at basically invited forms of expression. So most of the entries here are individual speakers or panel discussions. But there's also things like artwork, play performances, movie screenings in there as well. We have a Scholars Under Fire database, which is like what it sounds like. It's professors and postdocs and PhD students, but basically academics are targeted for sanction and punishment. And then we have a Students Under Fire database, which is the equivalent one, but for students and student groups. And I'd so two of these, the deplatforming database and the Scholars Under Fire one, we've got over 25 years of data. The student one, our data only goes back right now. What we've put up on the site only goes back to 2020. We have stuff going back to about 2015, but it takes a lot of time to kind of code those entries and get them in there. But basically, across the board in these databases, your intuition is borne out that calls to sanction expression in all of these databases have increased over the past 10 years. In the deplatforming one specifically, we track outcomes of, you know, was it, you know, was the attempt just an attempt and did they speak successfully, or was the event canceled? Did the speaker withdraw? Was the event disrupted or attempted to be disrupted? Those latter two have all increased tremendously over the past decade. They're at record levels now. The last 2 years of that database have recorded the most deplatforming attempts in history, in the history of our data. We're basically talking about one attempt every, like, 3 or 4 days on a college campus.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was hoping you were going to tell me, no.
That's all gone.
So I'll clarify, though, that that's attempts. So, like, yeah, a lot of those don't succeed,
yeah,
right? So those are attempts to get a speaker canceled, but that's happening a couple times a week, basically. And then a number of them do succeed, and speakers get shouted down or canceled, et cetera. So the trend is upward for that.
Interesting.
I would have thought it was headed in the other direction. That's interesting. All right.
Brief dip during the COVID years because no one was on campus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's a thought.
What, yeah, okay. One benefit. Yeah. We found the one benefit.
Oh, boy. All right. Now, Sean, this is Scott. One thing that drives me crazy, because I don't know, I'm an old-fashioned prude. I don't know. In the past year, I've seen an absolute uptick in the use of the F word in public discourse. Protests, mm-hmm, where people are toting signs, and there's the F word, usually followed by Trump, all right, or something. And, of course, the F word is spelled out. I'm seeing it in journalistic stories, where in the past, mm-hmm, you know, it would be F and some dashes. Now they're just putting the word right in there. Boom. Hunter Biden does an interview this week where it's like every third word is an F-bomb, 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 F-bomb. Nothing is beep, beep, beep. We're not hearing any of that anymore.
It's getting effing ridiculous,
yes,
is what it
that's
is.
That's right. There we
absolutely
go.
Absolutely right.
I mean, okay, is that freedom of speech, Sean? That just F-board, F-word, F-word. That drives me nuts because it's the old-fashioned prude in me. Like, stop using that language. But is that free speech? People are perfectly allowed to use speech like that.
Yeah, I mean, subtle. So yes, the word's protected. I think you could can find examples where maybe someone would consider it rising to the level of, like, excessive use, perhaps. If it's used, like, a lot and used in a very aggressive way, you could get into that domain, but that's probably rare and difficult. I think some of this is also, there's, like, calls to be more edgy on certain sides of the political spectrum right now and be more angry about things. So I think that's part of what's happening, too. But the word itself is protected. I think a journalist, per se, though, you know, an editor could say, you know, I don't want you putting that in there, and that's not necessarily them infringing on their speech. It's them making kind of an editorial decision. So I think there's some gray areas there when it's talked about with, like, you're an employee of an outlet, a media outlet. But in general, the word is protected speech.
Great. I'm not a fan, as you can probably tell.
Yeah.
All right, here's one. Now, It's interesting how much of this navigates late recently to colleges and universities. And I'm assuming you're familiar with this one because you're down in Philadelphia. We're here. This is closer to you. Muhlenberg College or Muhlenberg University recently fired a professor, a woman who ironically is Jewish, but she clearly does not like the current Israeli government. And she spoke out about that, I guess, on social media. She spoke out about that, and some people objected, and they went to, I guess, whoever's in charge of Muhlenberg. They called her on the carpet, and they fired her. And I may not like the opinion she shared, but I think she was unfairly fired. Now, you say, yeah, you're familiar with this story, all right? I mean, this sounds like free speech, just screaming free speech. How did this woman lose her job? What do you know there?
You're talking about Roz Segal, I believe. She was a tenured professor. She's a genocide scholar, actually. And she's effectively argued that the Israeli military is committing genocide in Gaza. Like, that's her argument. And not only was she fired from Muhlenberg, she was actually had been invited to give a talk at Northeastern, and that talk was canceled following this. She tweeted comments about Israel's military actions in Gaza. In her view, it's a genocide. I think Muhlenberg, we're seeing a lot of this, it's certainly more than we did under the prior administration. I think there's a lot of colleges and universities who they're almost like preemptively trying to get out in front of avoiding an investigation. Hey, the Trump administration, like how they've been started, you know, Harvard, Columbia, UPenn, et cetera. I think this could have been an attempt to get out in front of that, not wanting to be seen as not standing up strongly enough to anti-Semitism. But here's where I think, you know, fire, we disagree with this international human rights definition, the proposed definition of anti-Semitism. I mean, yes, I could see how there are definitely people who anti-Semites are going to be critical of Israel regardless, right? But not every criticism of the nation of Israel rises to the level of anti-Semitism. I think it's dangerous to kind of have the concept creep that way. I think that's largely what happened here to Roz Segal is, you know, she's criticized the government, but under the new definition of anti-Semitism that a lot of colleges and universities have adopted, that's now anti-Semitic speech.
Yeah,
Fire doesn't agree with that. I we don't think she should have lost her job, and the troubling thing.
I mean, is anybody, I don't know, counter-suing Muhlenberg? Like, hey, you shouldn't have fired her. She had free speech. That's not a fireable offense, or is it a fireable offense anymore?
Under this definition of anti-Semitism, it could, if a university has adopted that, it could then fall under like a Title VI violation if they're being if it's ruled as anti-Semitic and then it's quote discriminatory. But this is kind of like a legal game where it's like you have plausible reasons for doing it and you're just kind of arbitrarily applying this law to one scholar but not to another one.
All right, Donald Trump. This is very this is subjective. Donald Trump pretty much is suing anybody, any college, any media outlet that says things that he doesn't like. Now, there are some folks on the left. That's how they would describe it. All right? And yay, nay, folks, you can figure that out on your own. All right? But, he's had settlements with a couple of big media outlets because they did things he didn't like. And, of course, there's the whole deal with Harvard right now. And so, Sean, isn't all that free speech? What? I mean, where does that fall?
Some of it might be aggressive, and I don't know if he will win all of the suits. I think, you know, the example this week is a very interesting one, or last week, I guess, with CBS and Stephen Colbert. The timing looks suspicious. It definitely causes a smell, but I'd be shocked to find there being some kind of smoking gun that connects it all the way up to the White House and them directly saying, you must fire Colbert. I think it's probably more like what we just talked about with Roz Segal and Muhlenberg. CBS is kind of like, hey, this will probably help us if we just do this. And then you also bring in things like another way that they can kind of be like, well, we were going to do this anyway. The show loses $40 million and the ratings are down. So there's all these reasons to do it. But it just, you know, it doesn't pass. For a lot of people, it won't pass the smell test because of the timing. I think some of his lawsuits, defamation ones, yeah, he's free to do that. That can be hard to prove. He won the one against 60 Minutes. We'll see what happens with this Wall Street Journal one. Other ones I think were, as a pollster, I don't get the lawsuit of Ann Seltzer. She had an outlier poll. She put the results out. That happens. I actually immediately thought that poll was an outlier and didn't believe it for a second because it was kind of like, that's just not close to what any of the other polls in Iowa have said for the past 3 months. I think that one's probably a little more excessive and maybe not necessary. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, he is legally, free to file these lawsuits and do these things.
All right. Actually, the follow-up on that one, all right? When there is information out there that is clearly inaccurate, and I was thinking about this as I was prepping for our chat today, there's a group of folks called the Flat Earth Society. They believe that the Earth is flat. And I think they do it with a straight face. This isn't a gag.
Well,
they what?
In Iowa, they're right. It is absolutely. Is that not what they're talking
about? Well, not quite. This is like the whole planet is flat.
Oh,
okay. Even though we got a space station up there revolving around the planet, and we've taken pictures of the planet. So the flat Earth people are clearly inaccurate. And so when they go out and spiel, I mean, is that free speech, Sean? Because it is 100% inaccurate.
Generally is. And I say generally because there can be at least one exception. And it's funny that you picked that because this is an exception that I've written about in peer-reviewed papers at a university with a professor who has, free speech rights and academic freedom. If a French literature professor decides to, takes a question in class, assigns some reading and flat earth theory gets mentioned and a student asks them about it and he brings up his beliefs and advocates for flat earth theory in class, I mean, there's not much you could do to the French literature professor other than acknowledge that he's got some very curious beliefs. He was addressing a student question in class that came up from the reading, so it's legitimate for him to kind of be on this topic. However, if he was a geology professor, the university could fire him because it's like, okay, no one in your field thinks this, and you have no evidence for this. So there's narrow instances where that wouldn't necessarily be protected, but for the most part, it's you got some people with some very curious beliefs there, and the best we can do is challenge them and point out why they're wrong.
All right. Yeah, just...
Even crazier, there are people out there that think within the next couple of years the Pittsburgh Pirates could get to the postseason. I mean, nut jobs. Absolute nut jobs. But they're out there.
That'd be you, apparently, yeah.
No, okay. I once thought that. I no longer know right. That's going
to All right, a couple minutes and we're done. Now, I mean, Sean, we got to talk about colleges very quick, all right? Because you guys come out, I assume it's October, right? When the
September.
September.
Early September.
Okay.
Yeah, early September. We'll be putting out this year's college free speech rankings. It's usually right around Waiver Day, either the Thursday before or the Thursday after.
All right, well, I'll be in touch because we'd like to have you on again to see.
Yeah.
Again, I'm holding, again, this is from your website, thefire.org. There's a lot of great information there. From your ranking from last year, I think you had around 250 schools on the ranking. So not every college is on there.
Nope.
No, not even close. But of the 250, you have Penn State ranked number 228.
Yeah.
That's not very good. Yeah, do you? I don't know if you have this in front of you. Off the top of your head, why is Penn State so low?
So they have part of the ranking involves our policy reform team's rating of school speech policies. And so schools earn a bonus for having what's known as a green light rating. And they get penalized if they have a yellow light or a red light. It's kind of like a traffic light system. A green light means they don't have any policies on the books that seriously threaten freedom of speech. Yellow light is one or more of these are ambiguously worded. and so they can be like arbitrarily applied effectively when, you know, a university feels like applying them. And then red light is like these policies clearly are unconstitutional and threaten freedom of speech. So Penn State has a yellow light rating on speech policies. And then there's been schools also can gain or lose points based on how they resolve the speech controversies that we track. And so Penn State has a few that I know they got dinged for. There was an incident a few years ago with Gavin McGinnis, and I think it was Alex Stein. They were trying to hold like a comedy event or something, and the event got disrupted and wasn't able to be held. When that kind of happens, that sticks with the school for a few years. So they've had that bringing them down a little bit too. I'm looking at where they are. Well, I will say, I can give a little preview. They do better. They're going to do better in the fall. This year,
all right.
But still leave a lot to be desired, basically. But they are better.
All right, final question.
I guess we'll take improvement.
Final question.
Yeah. Maybe that's because Gavin McKenna signed there. I don't know. I'm a big hockey fan, so you guys got the big whale.
I'm telling you, we can hardly wait for hockey.
Now, a final question before we let you go, Sean. Again, you've got a bunch of markers here and things that you track and so on. You've got a line in, or a section in here, it says majority viewpoint, which I assume means the majority of people on campus. This is their
students.
Who's that?
Yeah, majority of students. The majority of students, what their political viewpoint is.
And you have Penn State listed as conservative.
I found
that interesting.
I'll tell you, it probably would be better characterized as mixed, to be honest.
Okay.
I think they're probably – I'd have to look it up. I don't have it right in front of me.
Right.
But it's – they're probably something like almost even. Like it's a ratio of like 1.05 to 1 or something. So it's probably very close.
Huh. Yeah, actually, you do have that down here. It's 1 to 1.05. So it's like 50-50.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, and this is based on our sample. So – we have a sample of probably like 400 or 500 students from Penn State. Obviously, it's a big university. It probably is more of a liberal. I would say it probably, if we surveyed every single one, it'd probably come out as more on the liberal end for sure, but probably not as liberal as places like schools in California, in New England, et cetera. I mean, we have some places that are 5-1, 10-1, 15-1. Smith College has notoriously multiple times in our survey not had a single conservative show up.
Boosh. Okay.
Wow. So things like that is basically yeah. So as skewed as it might feel on Penn State, I think it's actually probably a lot of the big state schools are a lot more balanced than some of the more private or smaller liberal arts colleges.
Well, Sean, we appreciate your time.
Yes,
thanks
thank
much.
You.
When your new ranking comes out, I'll be in touch because we'd like to have you on again.
All right. Great. Looking forward to it.
All right.